with you. It's April 7th, 2003, public hearing on House Bill 5030. This is the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Human Services. We are continuing to hear the Department of Human Services, Health Services, and their detailed budget presentation. And we have with us Barry Cass and Lynn Reed and Mr. Naughton, all ready to go. And Rosie is here with Rosette. For those of you who, I think everybody in the audience have been here before, so I won't have to repeat myself about the acronyms and contributions to Rosie. And also, if there's anyone here who has a cell phone, please turn it off so you don't disrupt the proceedings. You may begin, Lynn.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lynn Reed, Administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs within the Department of Human Services. On Thursday, we finished up with page 54 of the handout, and so I'll start with page 55 today, continuing with an identification of some of the cost containment measures that have been put in place over the course of the Oregon Health Plan. This next section deals with changes to the benefit package under the Oregon Health Plan. The primary tool for containing costs under the Oregon Health Plan was to be a reduction in covered conditions and treatments by redrawing where the line of covered services is on the prioritized list. In 96, 97, and then again in January of this year, we did have line reductions that were approved by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. We believe that that was as far as we could go right now with the 0103 prioritized list. However, the Health Services Commission has significantly reformatted that list for 0305, and there certainly is a strong possibility that we would secure federal approval to do further line movements on the 0305 list. Let's see, I skipped over July 99.
You had conversation of moving that line, you know, that we discussed in our other group and with the feds and how amenable they are to moving it?
Madam Chair, we have had a very brief discussion with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services on that respect. I believe that the Health Services Commission will be presenting its new list to you tomorrow. And coming out of that, I think that we can speed up the submittal of the 0305 list, which is the first step in that process, is to have CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, approve the new list, and then secondarily, once a decision is made on where the line would be drawn by the legislature, the discussion about approval of that, although we would give them a heads up of the area in which the legislature is looking. We have also, back in July of 99, we changed how we approved a number of services in order to look at providing only those services that were most cost-effective and increasing those that needed prior authorization. In February of 03 and then again in March of 03, we made changes to the benefit package for the OHP standard population, which we have talked about before, and I'm on page 55 of that handout. Moving on to client responsibility, back in December of 95 at legislative direction, we did implement a requirement that the clients that are the OHP standard clients of today start paying premiums for their benefits under the Oregon Health Plan. In July of 97, we instituted some increased enforcement of making sure that clients were enrolled in managed care plans in areas where it was required. In January of 03, we implemented co-payments for those groups of Medicaid clients that the federal regulations would allow, and these were minimal co-payments in the $2 to $3 range. And then, as we've talked about before, in February of 03, with the advent of OHP2, we had increased co-payments and increased premium requirements for the OHP standard population. On page 56, there are some program actions. This is just a laundry list of things that have occurred related to prescription drugs coming out of just one session ago, the 2001 session. So there were a number of items that we moved forward out of that session and then subsequent dealing with the revenue shortfall during this biennium, during the interim. We enhanced the drug rebate process to make sure that we were getting all of the rebates to which we were entitled. We enhanced the process to collect any outstanding drug rebates. In October of 2001, we reduced the dispensing fees and ingredient payments to pharmacies. In March of 2002, we initiated a limit on chronic drugs, the initial prescription, to just a 15-day supply to try and get at that issue of individuals didn't always need an entire 30-day supply when it was initially prescribed. And that action was rescinded in January of 2003. What we found was that it did not save money and, in fact, cost us more money by having to pay for two dispensing fees. In March of 2002, we also implemented something called Oregon Maximum Allowable Cost on multiple source drugs. Those are on generic drugs, where there were more than, I think, three suppliers that a pharmacy could purchase the generic drug from. We implemented an Oregon maximum price that we would pay for that drug, and that's been very successful in terms of introducing some savings to the pharmacy program. In July of 2002, we implemented the pharmacy management program, where for those clients in the fee-for-service delivery system, they would be essentially have all of their pharmacy needs met through a single pharmacy. In July of 2002, we also implemented the preferred drug list under the practitioner-managed prescription drug program. In September of 2002, we once again reduced ingredient payments.
Senator Carter.
Lynn, what does reduced ingredient payments mean?
I am sorry. Senator Carter and Madam Chair, we reduced the amount that we were paying to pharmacies for the cost of the prescription drug itself. And so back in October of 2001, we went from paying the average wholesale price minus 11% to average wholesale price minus 13%. In September of 2002, we went to average wholesale price minus 14%, another 1 percentage point reduction in terms of what we pay to pharmacies.
Follow it.
Have we seen a reduction in pharmacists who want to be on our list to help provide opportunity as a result of these reductions that they're encountering?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, we have not. There were a couple of areas where individual pharmacies had indicated that they would no longer serve our clients, but overall we have not seen a reduction in pharmacies serving our clients. Although we're testing that, as I think, as we move forward with further reductions.
Follow-up.
Is there what was the impact of Rite Aid dropping out with a big company like that? What was the impact of that?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, Rite Aid has not dropped out. None of the chain stores have dropped out. There was, they had sent a letter indicating as we were moving to average wholesale price minus 17% that that's one of the actions they would have to consider. Now, we're still at average wholesale price minus 14%. We haven't implemented a reduction, and none of those chains have dropped out. To continue, in September of 2002, we also implemented a requirement that physicians indicate or prescribers indicate on a prescription drug or on a prescription if the diagnosis for which this drug was being prescribed is a non-covered drug, in which case that would be the alert to the pharmacy not to bill the Medicaid program for that drug. In January of 2003, we implemented a primary incentive in order to encourage mail order, use of the mail order vendor in the prescription drug program. And that was, I mentioned that we had put in place some copays in January of 2003 related to prescription drugs, $2 and $3 copays. However, if a client obtains their drugs through the mail order vendor, those copays are waived. And then February 2003 was just the implementation of our new mail order vendor contract with significant discounts for the state. And in April 2003, I've indicated that we'll further reduce the ingredient payments on prescription drugs. This is the state plan amendment that's currently with the federal government to go to average wholesale price minus 15%. That still has not been approved, however, and we would not implement this prior to approval. On page 57, there are some other reimbursement-related changes that have taken place during this interim period. In October of 2001, we did not implement what would normally be a cost of living increase for providers. It's listed as discretionary. Some things grow automatically in terms of how they're billed. For example, prescription drugs, since it's based off of average wholesale price, that continues to average wholesale price continues to change. That's not discretionary, but there are some things where we actually go in and set the fees, like physician services, and we did not have any increase in October of 2001. For October of 2002, we did decrease the reimbursement levels for durable medical equipment and supplies and reduced the payment level to 80% of the Medicare allowed amount. However, that was rescinded in December of 2002, and we reverted back to 100% of the Medicare allowed amount. In October of
2002... I know that that was another one that was had a lot of discussion about... and I have asked that organization to look at some efficiencies and some issues, and at some point I'd like to get with you and George and Mr. Britton to go through their proposal for looking at some efficiencies and cost savings within their particular organization, and which may be helpful as we go through this budget process.
Excellent. Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll be glad to meet on that issue. October of 2002, once again, we did not implement a cost of living increase for providers. In March of 2003, we decreased the reimbursement to those diagnosis-related grouping group paid hospitals, DRG hospitals. These are hospitals of 50 beds or more. And we reduced our payment rates by 12% on, the effective date of that reduction was March 10th. And then also listed here, as it's one of our management actions coming out of the failure of ballot measure 28 and or House Bill 5100, was changing the reimbursement for type A and B hospitals. However, that requires statutory change. That bill hasn't been heard, and so it's just listed here.
Senator Carter.
Was this before they had made $589 million or afterwards?
I'm not sure I heard all of that, Senator Carter.
Would you repeat that, Senator Carter?
My question is, was that after the hospitals made $589 million or afterward?
Senator Carter, I'm not quite sure what the question relates to in terms of this particular management action, other than obviously a statement.
Actually, no, it is a question. That you decreased DRG hospital payments, but the record shows that hospitals receiving 29% of the dollars in health care made approximately $589 million last year. Was this management decision made at the end of their fiscal year, or was it before, so that it affected the bottom line?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, it did not affect that bottom line in terms of last year's earnings by the hospital, because this that was, I forget what time period that data was for, but it it was back in 2002, and this is a future action. Okay. Well, was a future action. It's just coming into play.
I was only asking that question, colleagues, because as I think it's going to be an issue of bottom lines for everybody. And when we ask people to take Medicaid patients, we are not only asking in terms of a public policy, but for all institutions in the state to come to the table, and we don't want them to go beyond their bottom lines. But in listening to many of my colleagues and knowing that, like Sacred Heart and Eugene, all those hospitals made good money last year. And so are we asking an unreasonable question when we ask institutions to come to the table, when my colleagues now have to vote on this? I think it becomes an issue that we need to know about. So I wasn't trying to commit any kind of faux pas or make any kind of pun or anything of that nature. I just think it goes into our knowledge bank in terms of what we're asking people to do.
Thank
you. So it was not a political decision, a question. Thank you.
Under other cost containment actions, just indicated that in January of 2002, we were able to...
I do have a question, because I know it takes statutory changes for this. What is the change request? That you said the bill is still in committee, or where is the bill?
Madam Chair, the bill has never had a hearing. What this bill would do is change the reimbursement for type A and type B hospitals. These are hospitals of less than 50 beds, and to the same methodology as is used for DRG hospitals.
So it would put them on the same level?
Yes, it would. Although we do have the option when we set up the DRG payment methodology to choose a hospital-unique conversion factor to go with the DRG units. So there are certainly some opportunities to utilize that system in a way that might disproportionately impact different hospitals. Under other cost containment actions, in January of 2002 was the effective date of a bill that was passed in the last session that put in place some third-party liability reporting requirements and lien rights. This was related to clients who have injuries of some sort, and then there's a third party that's liable for payment of those injuries. We had a requirement that clients report those injuries to us so that we could go out and look to stand in line to recoup the money that we have paid as a result of the injury. And what this bill did was also require the attorneys who are pursuing those cases for clients to report such cases to us. Then our third-party recovery unit works with those. And this also established an ability for us to pass on our lien rights to the managed care plans for those clients who are enrolled in managed care, and the managed care plans are actually paying for the services.
Lynn, how many employees do you have in your lien office, or your office that is working for recovery?
Madam Chair, that's an item we'll have to get back to you on. It's not a part of OMAP. It's part of located elsewhere in the department, so we'll get that information.
Where is it located?
It's located in community human services.
Okay. George, would you do two things for me? How many that's in that unit, and also what is the average life of the liability, and how quickly are they turning over those receivables to either the Department of Revenue or because we've put in place over the last few bienniums now, one of my pet projects, to try to speed up collection of receivables. So I'd like to
Lynn, when a person, when you put a lien against the party of question, the person has an accident or something of that nature, are the costs so divided where you're just receiving the dollars for the hospital, or the person has they gets nothing for their own personal injury? How does that work?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I don't know the answer to that question, so that'll be a piece of what we will bring back as well.
Because I've had about three complaints along those lines, and I was wondering, how do you divide that up?
All right. The last item on that page is an October 2 action that we put in place, which was starting the disease state management program, and that's set up for clients in the fee-for-service delivery system with asthma, diabetes, or congestive heart failure.
Madam Chair, before we leave that page.
I just have a question on that page. What has been the results of that management? Have there been cost savings? If there have, how much?
Madam Chair, it's too early yet to identify the cost savings. This has just started gearing up in October, and there are some guarantees related to 5% savings, but those guarantees don't come into play until the program has been in place for a year.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. If I could ask for an explanation of what that category means. Disease state management?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, we have contracted with a firm, McKesson, who has case managers, individuals they have, for example, a hotline that clients can call. They have managers who will work with the client, do follow-ups, checking in to see, for example, whether or not someone is properly monitoring their blood sugar levels. They'll work with the primary care or treating physician to help ensure better outcomes for the individual. They've found in some cases we have clients with these diseases who don't have primary care practitioners, and they help someone get set up with a primary care practitioner to do a better job in managing their health outcomes.
And follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a contract, you say?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, yes, it is. And this was an action we were directed to pursue coming out of the 2001 legislative session.
Thank you.
In terms of the population that's served with this group, these are clients who are in the fee-for-service delivery system, and already we have managed care plans who provide similar kinds of services for their managed care enrollees.
Barry, you were.
I did, Madam Chair. Just for the record, with respect to the type A and B hospitals, the bill that we were referencing is 2243, and it only refers to type B hospitals, and it has not had a hearing yet.
Type B only, huh?
Type B only. Okay. Type B hospitals, I believe, are the hospitals which are within 30 miles of a... What's the...
Type B hospital is under 50 beds within 30 miles of another hospital. There was also a legislative concept developed at the end of December that included both type A and type B hospitals, but it may never have been ended up in a final bill.
You know how many hospitals fall in that category?
We'll get back to you with that number.
Thank you.
Moving on to page 58, just an identification of some of the administrative actions that have been put in place related to the Oregon Health Plan. We've implemented over the course of the years electronic communications as much of government and business has changed a lot since we started in 1994. We now do, of course, emails and web postings, and we've replaced a lot of our hard copy printing by being able to direct individuals to the web. And we have manual administrative rules all posted and available to the public. We also have really moved forward in terms of electronic billing and what's called point of sale in the pharmacy arena, where individuals who are in the fee-for-service delivery system present their medical ID card, and a pharmacy can go in and do an electronic verification of eligibility. Is the drug covered? And actually that initiates the claim, and it's all done in a matter of seconds. We've also put in place what's called an electronic remittance advice, and this is the document that we would use to notify a provider what we've done with the claim that was submitted to us in terms of payment or denial or additional information that needed to be conveyed to the provider. And we have put in place automated client eligibility verification systems for providers to make it easier to know whether or not someone is a Medicaid client, whether they're enrolled in managed care, which plan they're enrolled with, what benefit package they may be entitled to. On page 59, some of the administrative actions have involved some simplification for managed care plans. That included streamlining the procedures for submitting encounter data, which is information we need to collect from the managed care plans under the terms and conditions of our waivers with the federal government. And we've done some significant streamlining and simplification of the financial solvency reporting. In addition to that, we contract out many of our administrative services. For example, we have a provider services hotline and the application center for folks who are interested in applying for the Oregon Health Plan is contracted out, and those are contracted out to the Oregon State Correctional Institution. The premium billing and collections is contracted out. Online access to client eligibility information is contracted out. The pharmacy point of sale system I mentioned is a contract. We also use First Health, and we use the Oregon Medical Professional Review Organization to do some of the prior authorizations.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shields.
With all these contracts, how often do you double check them to make sure you're getting the best in the marketplace?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, generally, well, it varies. We go through the state procurement process, and we will issue a request for proposals, and sometimes a contract might go through that process every 2 to 4 years. We don't do it on an annual basis.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Senator Cordley.
Could you help me understand the contracting out process to the Oregon State Correctional Institution? What is that process? Does it involve other bidders?
Madam Chair, Senator Cordley. I actually don't know whether or not it involves other bidders. There was a bill passed several years ago that directed state agencies to make use of the Oregon State Correctional Institution wherever possible. And I would believe that bill, without having going to it and looking at it, which we will do, most likely didn't require us to bid it out to the general populace. The services that are provided by that service, we do pay a rate. It used to be somewhere around $7 per hour in terms of the inmates who were answering phones, but we'll have to look it up and get some information for you.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. Just so that I'm clear on what specific service is being provided at OSCI, Oregon State Correctional Institution, Madam Chair. I will certainly do that before the end of the meeting. Are they providing the hotline and the application center?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, yes, those are two different services that they're providing for us. One is that provider services hotline, and there are certain kinds of provider calls that come in that they don't address. For example, if it concerns an inquiry about chemical dependency bill, that's automatically forwarded over to state staff. And we do have state staff present at all times supervising the inmates. And then the OHP Application Center is a separate service that they provide for us, but they do take 20-some thousand calls a month. Let's see if I've got something on that. They take about 24,000 calls a month. from people requesting applications.
Madam Chair, follow up. Well, appreciating that there is state supervision, how far into the application process do the OSCI workers go?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, they take enough information to be able to mail out an application to someone who is requesting an application. They can answer some questions that a person may have about the application process and general requirements for eligibility, but they don't get engaged in the actual determination of eligibility.
Follow-up. Have any concerns ever been raised around confidentiality or just the whether this is the appropriate place to have this type of service provided? Has anyone ever raised that question?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, there haven't been any issues raised around that. That clearly was a consideration at the time. The supervision that we've put in place is and some of the procedures that are put in place to ensure confidentiality, although you can't keep someone from remembering something as they walk away from their work. But they certainly don't take away anything with individuals' names or addresses on it.
And then one last question. Has this been the process since the beginning of the Oregon Health Plan?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, no, it was not the process at the beginning of the Oregon Health Plan. We did contract that out to a private vendor when we started up the Oregon Health Plan. And I'm thinking it was probably around 1995. It's been there for a number of years. But I can look and determine and find out what that start date was for you.
Madam Chair, I am interested in knowing something more about that history, and would also be interested in knowing what other like services are provided by the OSCI.
Right.
And staff.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, we'll see what we can find in terms of what other services are provided. I know they do something for Secretary of State, and I think they may be the contact line for general inquiries into the state of Oregon. And we'll get some info for you on that.
We can ask the Department of Corrections to give us a list of services that they are providing through inmate services. Senator Shields,
if I could just make it clear, I'm not making a judgment about it one way or the other. I just need more information.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Shields?
I guess I would join Senator Gordley. I particularly had one question. I've been in most of the institutions either as a senator or as a clergyman. And when I talk to people, they talk about being paid a dollar a day or whatever for this or that. Did you really say that these folks are paid $7 an hour when they're working in this particular job? And doesn't that create a great disparity between prisoners, some of whom would be getting a great deal of income and others would be getting a dollar a day? I don't understand.
Right. Madam Chair, Senator Shields, we will have to get back to you, but there are also some requirements that are state requirements related to how much you have to pay, which deal with the minimum wage. But that doesn't mean that the inmate gets use of the entire $7. Some of it goes, for example, to victim assistance and restitution, and so it's only a small amount of money that goes into a usable account.
Given all that just for you, Madam Chair, given all that Senator Gordley was asking, it just seemed to round out that picture, it would be good to have that information.
Yeah, we can ask DOC, but, I do know that, at least I paid $20 in advance. Department of Corrections, as to what the payment policies are, and also what the accounting system is. I know that years ago, their system was, where the person who earned their money went into their account, and their account then paid for, you know, whether it was restitution, whether it was child support, you know, what they owed, and then what they had left. And it also, which is interesting, because it provided a fund for individuals when they were released, so that they did have some kind of money to and some support when they left the institution. And I think for some of us who have worked in this field, it's a good thing, because you don't want them going back into the community without having any resources whatsoever. And you also want, which I at least I think we would want, is individuals learning how to become responsible for you know, those things, whether it's child support or whether it's restitution, that they're required to do. I know often I think in that particular environment, we don't train individuals how to be responsible. Then when they come out, you know, it's kind of like they said, somebody else done it for them all the time, so they don't know how to do it. So we can get that from the Department of Corrections and ask them that question, so I don't make it again. Thank you. You may continue.
Madam Chair, I want to thank you. You obviously know a great deal more about it than I do, and I just thought it would be a good adjunct to the questions that Senator Gordley asked.
It is good, and I don't know if I obviously know more, but I think when I in my other life, when I was here in Children's Services Division, as well as when I was on McCall staff and Atiyah staff, I did work on the project that had to do with separating the women's prison from the men's prison. You know, a long time ago, they were connected. And so in those processes, you get to kind of know what's going on inside the institutions and what have you. And then I've worked, as you probably know, both Ted and I had an after-prison ministry, which was, you know, trying to build a bridge back from the institution back into the community. And often, I might share this with you, on Sunday, Claudia Black with Department of Corrections asked me to attend the graduation out at the at Cow Creek. And so even though I'd lost an hour's time, I was up early and went to Cow Creek. They had the ceremony at 8 o'clock in the morning, and it was women who had completed the parent training program last session. As some of you know, I was also involved with that, and we passed that through the budget. Because my concern is that we're not giving tools for people to come back and to be back into the society. 40 women graduated yesterday, and it was very heartrending, you guys. I wish all of you could have been there, because part of the learning, and it might sound very, someone said it might sound silly at first, that you give them a boiled egg, and they have to nurture this egg. And one lady, it was interesting, she said she had her egg. She painted the egg, gave it yellow hair to match the blonde hair of her son, and put blue eyes on it. And in caring for this egg, she dropped it. She was totally devastated, because the realization for her was that you were talking about, she was talking about her son. The other piece that was that yesterday, they give all of them have a stuffed animal. We don't think anything about these things, and it was a teddy bear, and they had to take care of it. That was theirs to take care of. That was their child. And through these months of taking care, if they left their child unattended, you know, they got the committee would then say, you know, what you did, why you did it, so it's kind of interesting, and if you could have seen the mothers and the children that were there and their families, the support group that was there, it was very heartrending. I believe that I told Claudia Black that somehow as a community, when the individuals are released, they still have to have some kind of support system when they get out. But that's digressing, but so I've had some involvement with corrections.
Thank you. I'm on page 60 now. This is just a visual chart in terms of the claims volume that is processed by OMAP, showing that in 2003-05, we expect that we'll be processing about 56 million claims. Our staffing level is at 174 FTE for 03-05. And this just shows you that information from 93-95 through today and expected for the next biennium. On page 61, just takes a comparison of 93-95 to the 03-05 governor's balance budget. And that shows that expenditures in our programs have increased by 133%, and the claims volume has increased by 178%. The eligibles have increased by 47%, and then the FTE is a decrease of 25%. And with that, I'm ready to for Judy Moore Peterson to join us at the table.
Lynn. Just a quick question. I think I read in the paper this morning, yesterday, that the population figures were incorrect, and so Oregon may come out with about $4.4 million more than what would have been allocated to us. Can you check that for me and get back to me on?
Madam Chair, I'm not $4.4 million related to federal match or
Medicaid. Yeah.
Okay. I'll look at it and get back to you.
I wasn't sure whether they said they for once going to finally increase our Medicare rates, but I mean, that's a whole other subject.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Judy Moore Peterson, and I am the manager for the Analysis and Evaluation Unit in the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. And I, like the rest of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, am a proponent of prepaying. So, pay my capitation here. also, put my name Rosie.
That's Rosette.
Rosette.
Rosie looks like she's closed. So
I will start the presentation on page 62. I do want to note that much of what I'm covering is also in the Ways and Means, the actual Ways and Means document, starting on approximately 4-13. There's more narrative in the Ways and Means document than with this here, which is just an introductory kind of PowerPoint presentation. What I'll be covering are some of the Oregon Health Plan goals and trying to put that into a larger national context, provide you with some numbers on what some of our accomplishments are around access and quality to care. So first, it has to do with the national comparisons. You'll see that in some charts that follow this next page on page 63, that Oregon ranks 44th in Medicaid expenditures per eligible. That's per Medicaid eligible. And when in regards to actual Medicaid spending, with the advent of the Oregon Health Plan, we dropped below for every dollar that was spent by national Medicaid. We had been above that, and then we began to spend lower than that. So if you turn the page of page 64, there's two sets of tables there. The one on the left shows Medicaid expenditures on a per state resident basis, and this is from the most recent time that we had available to us, which is federal fiscal year 2000. You'll see that we're number 34 in the state resident spending. And if you look at the table next to that, we're 44th when it comes to Medicaid expenditure.
Mr. Britton.
Judy, just to clarify, is this all Medicaid expenditures or just those associated with the health plan?
It's all Medicaid expenditures.
So it includes long-term care?
Yes, it does. And that data is... We can work at splitting that out, but it actually isn't Not every state accounts for its long-term care dollars the same way, so it's difficult to get a comparative figure for you nationwide. Mm-hmm. What you see on the table on the left-hand side is that these are all the western states, and you can see that, by and large, the western states don't spend as much per state resident as the rest of the nation. We're all below midpoint, right? And that's not the case for Medicaid expenditures per Medicaid eligible. Okay? If you turn to page 65, it's the same information, but using a different group of states. This group of states are other states that have the Section 1115 waivers from the federal government. Again, it's not too surprising, but Oregon, again, is quite low in its overall per capita as per state resident, as well as the Medicaid expenditures per eligible.
Yeah. Madam Chair.
Senator Shields.
On the second chart on page 64, I can't understand. Could you give us some insight into why California is so much less than anybody else in that ranking, 51st? How do they manage to do that?
Medicaid expenditures for Medicaid eligible. Well, they would be spending.
Oh, I think
they would have a lot more.
Yeah.
Do you have?
Go ahead.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
So they would have a lot more eligibles, and so that their dollars would be spread out a lot further. But we could take a look at closer to that as to where the spending is.
Well, I thought that might be the case until I looked at New York and your other one, and New York would have a lot more eligibles, and they're at 7,600 as compared to California at 2,100.
But New York also has much, much higher healthcare expenditures. The rates of healthcare expenditures, the overall costs are simply a lot more expensive than they are, and it tends to be on the West Coast.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, if I could also add a little bit of information, well, not information, but speculation here, in terms of the differences. Indeed, the West Coast is traditionally much cheaper in terms of how it delivers health care, and California is a good example of that compared to the East Coast. So that's one of the factors here. An additional factor could be the mix of eligibles. To the degree that California is serving a large number of children are of lesser cost, and our program has expanded eligibility to some individuals that have quite high costs, and so that would increase our average per member per month.
Yes, I think come under the heading of a wisecrack, Madam Chairman, but it does seem that we ought to get paid some kind of bonus when we're this much less expensive than New York, for instance. It doesn't. Somehow it just doesn't equate.
If you live in New York, you'd probably understand. It's the cost of care plus population. It's not just one or the other. It's the two joined together.
But, I mean, New York is number one in the country in ranking. There's no benefit to Oregon being 44th. Or 34th in these two categories. It's like when you get efficient and when you do it well, you're almost penalized.
Mm-hmm.
You follow what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, that's a commentary and not a question.
That's especially true in Medicare. We did get penalized for being efficient.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You want to turn to page 66 and 67. This is an index here, so you can see that the line across, straight across, is the U.S. Medicaid expenditures per eligible going back to 1980. And that squiggly line that starts off higher and then drops below is for what we spent per Medicaid eligible over time. And where you see it drop below that from the spending of $1.08 for compared to a dollar to 90 cents, that's with the advent of the Oregon Health Plan. What you also see is that we have remained lower, but we are starting to move back up. And that could be for a variety of reasons. Costs could be going up here, as well as the rest of the nation could be catching up on reducing costs per eligible as well. The medical price index chart that's on page 67, the shaded gray line is indexed for medical price inflation for the U.S. national average. The one with the little square boxes is for the U.S. Or is for the Portland metropolitan area. And the line that's below that is our line of what our average increase or inflation, if you want to speak of it that way. And you can see that we have in the Medicaid program, our inflation has been lower than the U.S. national average and has been lower as well as the Portland metropolitan area. However, since approximately 1999, you'll also note that the Medicaid line has paralleled the U.S. Portland metropolitan area inflation line. And I think what that demonstrates is that our costs are very much influenced and our inflation costs are influenced by the larger healthcare market. It's not us independent by ourselves. Okay. I'll move along here. There's on page 68 is some narrative, and then it's some of the points that are covered in the narrative are addressed in charts that follow that. But let me just walk you through that. Our estimation is that over 1 million people, probably almost close to 1.5 million people, have gained access to the Oregon Health Plan since it began in 1994. What this has meant, and this is an estimation, is that nearly 1 in 3 of all Oregonians have been on the Oregon Health Plan at some point in their lifetime.
Question.
Representative Smith. G. Smith.
Thank you, Chair Winters. Without trying to get ahead of you, I want to see if I can gain some clarification. When you look at 69, which is attached, it talks about the 2002 number of 12.9% of the percentage of Oregonians enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan. And then back on the 1 in 3 all Oregonians have been on the Oregon Health Plan at some time. What's the average length of time that a citizen is on the health plan? And perhaps you could explain a little bit more about the circumstance about the discrepancy between 33% of Oregonians and now 13% at any one time.
That's a very good question, Madam Chair, Representative Smith. That discrepancy, it's actually not a discrepancy, and you've picked up on the exact reason as to why you have essentially a third of the population being on the Oregon Health Plan. It has to do with the length of time in which individuals are on the Oregon Health Plan, and that varies considerably between the different eligibility groups. So children and the expansion population tend to stay on for approximately 6 months. Give or take some. Pregnant women, it's on the time period of which they first get enrolled with their pregnancy and then 2 months afterwards. And I don't have the exact, I can't remember the exact time period. The number of 4 months is in my head, but I'm not sure that that's correct as to how long. I think it's actually longer that for pregnant women, and then their children is approximately 4 months or above. I'd have to check on that. But each different eligibility group has different lengths of time that they tend to stay on. Children, which is maybe looked at actually as a good thing, in that if their family circumstances improve, they may move off of the Oregon Health Plan, don't have as long of a time period on the Oregon Health Plan as some of the disabled group, mandatory eligibles, or age of the blind, or old age assistance. In those cases, a lot of times, once they come onto the Oregon Health Plan, they stay on the Oregon Health Plan for extended time periods.
See, I guess I was reading that as Oregonians are only on the Oregon Health Plan when they need assistance. And then when that need goes away, until they need health care again, they're not part of the system. And I don't know if that's accurate or not. That was just my interpretation.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, it's a very complex kind of interplay between people. Their circumstances may improve, and they may get a job, and whether that job has health insurance or not, but their incomes go up, and then they fall off the Oregon Health Plan. There was a study that was done that looked at that a number of individuals, the reason that they fell off the Oregon Health Plan, so to speak, was because their incomes was raised, and was... I'd have to get the exact study for you, but I can't to recall how many of those people had health insurance in their new circumstances. If you recall Dr. Jackson when he was here last week, he also said that as people, you know, people come on and off as they do need assistance. And, I mean, the ultimate goal is to have people move off medical assistance and be able to make it without medical assistance, and that we hope is happening, although we do know that people have increased their incomes, they don't have another job or anything, and they come back onto the Oregon Health Plan as they need health care, et cetera. The other thing that happens is that they lose their job and then they need medical assistance again, or they do exactly what you said. They have a health condition. They come onto the Oregon Health Plan. That gets better, and then they drop off. That's also when people who have very little money and they're making decisions about how to spend their money, that we do know that that's things that people do.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morris.
Before we get too far away from page... pages 64 and 65.
Going back.
Yeah, I'm perplexed by these numbers. I just want to make certain that these numbers do not reflect Oregon's commitment in total to taking care of the it represents the reimbursements from the federal government, and it's how we compare relative to other states with the federal component, not our total spending.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, it actually includes both the federal portion as well as the state portion. But you are correct. It would not include everything that we spend on indigent care, meaning like the safety net clinics, et cetera, or the uninsured. That would not be captured here. This would be Medicaid expenditures only. The other thing that's not captured here would be I'm going to have to use an acronym, the SCHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program dollars. Because every state runs its, if it has the Children's Health Insurance Program up and going, some of them are independent from the Medicaid program, some of them are included in the Medicaid program, et cetera, and there's no way to track those dollars. So those dollars are also not included in these figures.
Did that clarify for you?
Yeah, but it raised some questions, but we won't deal with them here. But I
think part of the thing that it raises across the country is capturing data to try to do comparison is extremely difficult because each state, you know, has their accounting systems or their way of doing systems differently. And so even though we constantly ask for comparison data, we don't always get that data back because of these 50 separate states. What we're only able to get back is those things that the federal agency requires of all of us to input. And so if we have some kind of different programs inside our state, that doesn't show up.
Madam Chair, that's correct. And the other thing to keep in mind is that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services have actually changed their reporting requirements, and so it makes coming up with these figures more complex as well, and certainly it is for trending over time. But every state does run its Medicaid program differently, and it makes national comparisons a challenge. We tried to come up with a few states and put them here, but we recognized that we could put them up there, but how well you can compare them is a challenge. This would just give you a general idea. And so what you can see in general is that in Western states, we don't spend as much per resident or per Medicaid eligible as elsewhere.
Could I test this one more time, Madam Chairman? It's bothering me. I had the assumption that with the advent of the Oregon Health Plan, in combined state dollars and federal dollars, that we would be certainly above the national average and would be a leader, in fact, in the Western states. And what you're suggesting by these numbers, that we are not?
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, what these numbers, how we interpret these numbers, is that it shows that we're very effective with the dollars and how we spend them. That we pay reasonable costs, that we try to manage our costs, and that we try to provide a set of services that are sort of at a reasonable level. And so when we look at these charts, that's how we think about them. We think about ourselves as, wow, we're doing a really good job with the dollars that we're spending, and that we're spending it effectively. And when we compare, whatever we can compare ourselves as far as performance measures or what we can accomplish, we try to make sure that we're providing a certain level of service as well with those dollars. So I would respectfully disagree with that assessment that we would need to spend a lot in order to get quality services.
Thank you. That clarifies it.
Well, at the risk of opening a can, which I like to do. Again, I'm not sure you were here, Senator Morse. These dollars do not just include dollars for the Oregon Health Plan. They include Medicaid, long-term care spending. They also include, I presume, Medicaid for developmentally disabled and mentally ill people as well, correct? Is that right?
Yes, it would include all Medicaid.
All Medicaid and associated state match with those Medicaid dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So to the extent that our state differs from any other state in terms of the waivers that we have for these programs, the populations that are covered, that would also account for differences in those amounts.
But I do think that it's well to know that the factors of efficiency are the attempt to utilize the dollars more effectively does really, when you look at the differences in comparison in states, whether you're talking Western or Oregon in comparison to the U.S. So, and that was the objective of the Oregon Health Plan.
That's right. Madam Chair, there's a book put out by It's put out by AARP, and I honestly don't know what that acronym stands for.
Oh, yeah. It has to be chronologically advantaged to understand what that means.
I apologize.
Wait till you get your card in there.
It will come soon enough, I'm sure. But the... according to... It has the state profiles, and one of the elements in the state profiles for Oregon. It does point out here that for the fiscal year of 2000, according to this figure, that Oregon spent 32% of its Medicaid expenditures on long-term care, and the state, or the U.S. average, it notes here for 2000 was approximately 35% in long-term care. We can investigate if there's other information about nationwide so that we could put those figures in
helpful.
Here.
Thank you.
We can see if that information is available as well.
Okay.
Thank you. So we're on page 68, going back there. In 1 year, in 2001, the total number of Oregonians receiving Oregon Health Plan benefits, and this would be all people receiving some form of Medicaid or Oregon Health Plan, is the 626,942. That's obviously not a one-time count. That's everybody during the whole year. We're close to half are children under the age of 19. So that's a very large number. And that we do find that approximately at any one time, approximately one-fifth of the total child population is on the Oregon Health Plan. Another note here, and we'll be covering this in just a little bit here, is over one-third of births in Oregon are paid for by Medicaid. And then some of our most vulnerable Oregonians, this is just the overall numbers, so that there were nearly 9,000 children in foster care, nearly, this is over a whole time period, not at one time period. And then our estimation is that approximately 50,000 children had a special health care need, and that there were over 100,000 elderly and disabled over a time period. The chart on page 69 shows the percent of Oregonians enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan. And this is a one-time figure, so that you could take a look at a population, a census, and then take a look at how many Oregonians were on the Oregon Health Plan at that time period. And what you see is that in 1995, we're reaching that peak again of 13% of all Oregonians being on the Oregon Health Plan. If you track that with the overall uninsurance rates, which is not on this page, in 1990, the uninsurance rate was 16%. In 1992, it had risen to 18%. In 1994, it dropped to 13.6%. In 96, it continued to drop 10.7%. In 1998, it remained fairly steady, and it was still at 11% estimation. In year 2000, it was 12.2%. And then the preliminary figures that have not been officially released yet are that it's gone up, so that in 2002, the estimation at the present time is almost 14%.
So, pardon me.
Pardon?
You mean in 2003, it's almost 14%.
No, the survey was done in 2002.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. So this figure I should write almost 14 instead of 12.9.
So that in 2002, the figure for uninsurance rates was 14%. So we have a tracking as you see what you see happening is uninsurance rates go down. Percent of Oregonians on the Oregon Health Plan also drops. As uninsurance rates go up and as the economy worsens, you see both a rise in people on the Oregon Health Plan, percentage of the population, as well as the uninsured. They do track together. It was nice to see that in 1994 that the uninsurance rates did drop from 18, you know, they dropped from in 1992 from 18% to 1994, 14%, and we saw this rise in the Oregon Health Plan, which we attribute to the coming on of additional people onto the Oregon Health Plan. On this next page, it just simply shows the overall counts of children on the Oregon Health Plan. If you look at what the index is, you'll see that it actually starts at 220,000 on your left-hand column. So that's why the differences look kind of, it's emphasizing the change over time. And the difference is when you see the rise from 1998 to 1999, that's the start of the children's health insurance program. That's when we began that, so that number starts to show up there. And then in 2001, you see quite a dramatic rise here in children, and that is most likely a result of a poor economy. We have a lot more people seeking assistance.
Madam Chair.
I'm sorry, Senator Shield.
You said if the CHIP program account, there I go, now I owe some money.
Yep.
Accounts for the jump from 249 to 260. What about the family health? I can't say it without an acronym because I can't remember the whole name. Did it affect it somewhere?
Madam Chair, yeah. Senator Shields.
Family Health
Insurance Assistance Program.
Does it factor into these figures somewhere?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, no. None of those that portion of the Oregon Health Plan are included in it here. This is okay. Strictly Oregon Health Plan Medicaid portion.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, Senator Shields, I just want to comment on the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, which also began in 98 at the same time as our Children's Health Insurance Program. Even at its peak, it was serving less than 5,000 individuals, and about a third of the people covered in that program were children.
And actually, staying on that same chart, one other comment has to do with the uninsurance rate amongst children. Back in 1990, the uninsurance rate for children was at 21%, which is amazingly high. In 1994, it was at 14%. By 2000, the uninsurance rate for children had dropped to 8%. And we are, the preliminary figures that have not yet been released, we are seeing a bump up in the uninsurance rates, but nothing compared to the 21% or the 14% yet for uninsurance rates for children. On page 71, I don't think I'm skipping a page here.
No.
It shows the percent of births to Oregonian women that are paid for by Medicaid, as well as they're paid what's known as self-pay. Self-pay means that either, the women would have paid for it themselves, which may mean that they have an awful lot of money or very little money. It's going to be both of those. And you'll see that, by and large, the births paid to women has been more or less the same over time, with just a slight increase in recent years. And then you have been noting a drop, a very slight drop, in uninsured births or self-pay births. And we've been working very closely with public health and trying to identify women to get them enrolled onto the Oregon Health Plan if they're eligible, to try to get their prenatal care and their births covered by Medicaid to provide better birth outcomes, et cetera. And we're taking this as a sign that our efforts are working. If you can, there is national information comparing percent of births to Medicaid, but there's not a comparison to the self-pay. And what you find is that if you're looking at the births to Medicaid, the highest in the nation is Louisiana, with 63% of all their births being paid by Medicaid. And Oregon is kind of right in the middle there with, like, number 33. And a lot of the southern states are the ones with the really incredibly high proportions of their overall births to Medicaid, which is likely a reflection of the poverty status within that particular state, as opposed to any way that they're particularly running their Medicaid program. The only exception to that is likely to be Vermont, which also had close to half their births being paid by Medicaid, and their Medicaid program goes up to, I believe, 200% of the federal poverty level, so they're capturing more. Okay. The next set of tables, which starts on page 72, is going over prenatal care and immunization rates and then preventive care. And we'll note that on page 73 is prenatal care in the first trimester, and this information comes from our vital statistics. That's how we are able to compare ourselves with the other Oregonian women. And you can see that the Medicaid, women who are on Medicaid, have been going up, sort of up and down, sort of an interesting curve line there, but we're close to 70% of all women receiving prenatal care in the first trimester in the Medicaid program, which is still considerably lower than the overall average for Oregonian women, but higher than what the average is for women who have no health insurance, self-paid. We do have a number of programs that try to target prenatal care and try to target women, getting them into the Oregon Health Plan. If they are eligible, try to get them into prenatal care and identify them and get them adequate resources. We still have a lot of work to do in that area, and we'll continue to target it. We're pleased that we're getting close to that 70% level. And when you compare us to national, that is close to the national average is approximately 70%. The next page, on page 74, shows tobacco use in pregnancy. Again, this data comes from the vital statistics, from the birth certificate data. And what you see here is that women who have the Oregon Health Plan or have Medicaid pay for the birth have almost twice, more than twice the rate of smoking or tobacco use during their pregnancy as does the general Oregon population of giving birth. The nice thing to see is that we have a very dramatic drop overall in both our population, the Medicaid population, as well as the overall Oregon population. It's almost the same rate of decrease as far as a decline of approximately 40% from 1990 to 2001. In recent years, from 1998 to 2001, we have a number of programs that also target pregnant women, trying to encourage them to smoke, identify them early on, get them into quit smoking.
Judy, Mr. Britton has a question.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, Judy.
Okay.
Just on page 74, the Oregon figures are not everyone else. They are overall, so they include the Medicaid. Okay, so the rate probably is even much lower.
Right.
Because
if we cover a third of all the births, then we would be impacting, playing into, going into that figure, right? Mm-hmm. So, yes, the overall rate would drop if you took the Medicaid population out of the Oregon population, which we did not do for this particular figure. We have seen a general decline. We have lots of programs that are targeting smoking, trying to get them into something called maternity case management to help get treatment for them, et cetera. One of our methods that we've been using is referring them to the Oregon Quit Line, which, as many of you know, has had its funding as of today defunded till the end of the biennium. And so we will lose one of our tools in trying to help those women who are trying to quit smoking if that funding isn't restored. It is in the general, the governor's balanced budget, and we're hopeful that it will be refunded in the new in the next, the 03-05 biennium.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Could you also show us or prepare for us what the trend looks like for low birth rate, what that experience has been over the same period of time? And if it's possible to disaggregate that data by race and ethnicity, that would also give us some comparative data that would help us better understand the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, we will do that. Oh, just for your information as well, the smoking rate for adults on the Oregon Health Plan is 37%, so that the smoking rate for pregnant women is considerably lower than that. It's still quite high.
We have a film today, so Judy, just continue. And the film is about 15 minutes.
Okay. The next chart shows childhood immunization rates, and it's for looking at whether children are sufficiently immunized by the age of 2. We're looking at it their age 19 to 35 months, and that stands for whether they've received their 4 diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis, their 3 polio shots or vaccinations, and then their 1 measles, mumps, and rubella shot. And what this shows you, and this is one of those charts we were able to come up with U.S. averages, but not U.S. Medicaid averages. So the closest we had was U.S. below poverty. We can see that overall in Oregon, our immunization rates aren't great. They're on average with what they the children are with the U.S. below poverty rates. The nice thing to see is that for the Medicaid program for our children, the Oregon Health Plan children, we do see a general slow but steady increase to 73% now, which is the equivalent of what we're on par now with what the U.S. Below poverty children are, and we're very close to what the overall Oregon average is. So we've been showing a nice steady increase. We've had a number of hard work in trying to address that, some pilot projects, some immunization reminder projects. We've worked very closely with our public health immunization program partners on that.
Representative Smith.
Yes, Madam Chair. Why is OHP children percentages below Oregon? Now, Oregon means the if they're not on the Oregon Health Plan, children who are not on the Oregon Health Plan, is that correct? Versus children who are on the Oregon Health Plan?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, yes, Oregon would mean all Oregon children of that age group. And then the bar that's on the far right-hand side there, we are lower than the...
Why is that?
You know, because... In general, people who are below poverty, there tend to be more barriers to getting their immunizations than there are in individuals with easier access to health care. Sometimes these children are coming on right when they're born or right after they're born, and so this is an overall average of all the kids in that particular age group.
Judy, how much of it may be transitory, because you're talking about a population that moves a lot, or moves somewhat more than...
Madam Chair, there's a number of reasons, and the fact that they move a lot, that they may not have a person who can see them on a regular basis, who can get them in. And sometimes it's hard. For example, we have a pilot project in which we let providers know this child is due for their next set of shots, and if the child has moved, then they're hard to find, et cetera. So there's a variety of reasons as to why it's slightly lower.
So I cannot make the assumption then, just because a child is on the Oregon Health Plan, that their immunizations are up to date, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, you wouldn't be able to make that about for any child that their immunizations
right,
be up to date.
Right, even the highest on the self-insured or whatever we want to call that category is only 80%, which we still have a 20% disparity there. So I guess I'm surprised by that. I'm not criticizing it at all. I'm surprised that there are no guarantees just because a child is on the Oregon Health Plan that they are indeed getting the adequate health care all the time that they should have.
Madam Chair,
for all these reasons that you say.
Right. And in 2001, we were equivalent to, we were very close to being the equivalent of what children who you know, all the other children in the state of Oregon were, so that how close you can get to that adequate immunizations, it's a problem for all of Oregon, not just the Oregon Health Plan or not just the Medicaid program. And so we are trying to do our part in trying to get our kids up to date. We do, right? Like to call your attention, we actually are working on a project with the immunization program and what we're calling the Late Start Project. And what we identified in working with the immunization program is that a higher proportion of children on the Medicaid program or on the Oregon Health Plan were not starting their immunizations within the correct time period. There was a delay, and we are in the middle of trying to figure out why that is. Why are they not starting their immunizations, to see if there's a system problem? Are they not getting signed up for the Oregon Health Plan in time? Sort of what's going on with this? So we are trying to identify system issues and trying to get kids immunized.
Great. Thank you.
Just an observation. In 98, the national level was at 81, and they're slightly dropping. They've slightly dropped to 79.
Right.
You know, we were at 63, and we've gone up to 73. So you see what stayed rather constant is actually Oregon was at 76 overall in 98, and then dropped slightly to 73, went up to 80, and then back down at 75.
Right.
But in 98 was when we did start the children's health.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. Okay. So you've seen since beginning children's health actually...
We have improved.
We have improved.
Yes, we have. But I just thought, to me, it really struck me as odd. That's what we were talking about.
Well, I think we would love to see everybody fully immunized.
Sure.
That's the ultimate goal. The next page, page 76, is an aggregate figure that shows you what percentage of Oregon Health Plan members, regardless of how long they've stayed on the Oregon Health Plan, received at least one preventive visit. This includes both a dental preventive visit or a medical preventive visit. We identified these preventive services from the Health Services Commission list. So we were taking a look at that list and seeing how it was doing. And what you can see is that there's a slow but steady increase, very slow increase, in children receiving preventive care. But we have not seen that same sort of general increase for adults. Not exactly sure why. We think it probably has to do with the changing in times of kind of the disruption in the overall delivery system. We had some managed care plans drop out, and then the people were moved to fee-for-service, et cetera. So there's a number of reasons as to why continuity of care might be a contributing factor to the adults not receiving the same level of preventive care. The next figure, the next chart, is on the general client satisfaction with the Oregon Health Plan, and this is just a measure of their overall satisfaction with their health care in general. It's taken from a survey, and the reason that we include this is because people's perception of their own health care is very important to how well they follow their physician's orders or doctor's orders in taking care of their health, et cetera. And so the more satisfied they are, the more likely they are to follow their doctor's considerations and what they tell them they should be taking for their prescription drugs, et cetera. And usually communication with the doctor's itch is one of the main contributing factors to the overall client satisfaction. What this shows you is that in general, Oregon Health Plan clients are, in general, relatively satisfied, and they have maintained that level of satisfaction over time. These numbers are very, very comparable to the national Medicaid, which is in year 2002 was at 85%, and then the national commercial rate was at 84%. So our Medicaid Oregon Health Plan clients are right in there, and that's one of our goals, is to maintain satisfaction at least at 80%.
Judy, I'm going to, because we still have quite a bit, and I know there'll probably be some discussions when we get into managed care enrollment and some of the other categories.
I'd like to stop.
Save those till tomorrow because I would like to. I had requested this film, and I would like to have the members see this particular film. And so, why don't we?
It's in there.
It's ready to go.
Okay. Thank you.
I've got my cameraman and all ready.
Start with the criminal case, State of Oregon versus David Lowell White, 99C54510. Defendant is present. He's out of custody, and with him is his attorney, Mr. Lindsey Partridge. We have a resolution in this criminal case, Your Honor.
What's your name?
David Lowell White.
Mr. White, you're pleading guilty to criminal mistreatment and possession of controlled substance, both Class C felonies, possible 5 years in jail. Are you doing this freely and voluntarily?
Yes, sir.
Are you satisfied with your attorney?
Yes, sir.
Have you gone over your plea petition? Do you understand this?
Yes, sir.
Are you pleading guilty because you are guilty?
Yes, sir.
Tell me what you did. You understand by pleading guilty you're waiving your right to trial by jury,
yes, sir.
Right to confrontation, and right to self-incrimination?
Yes, sir.
All right, I'll accept the plea.
Your Honor, this is Kay Lynn Carey. The case is 99C54509. She's here as well. She's out of custody, and with her is her attorney, Catherine Dixon. We have a plea agreement here, I believe, as well.
Your name?
Kay Lynn Carey.
You're pleading guilty to criminal mischief and possession, both Class C felonies, possible 5 years.
That's criminal mistreatment, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, you're right.
Maybe twice a week sometimes.
Do I hear three times a week? Do you like an auctioneer here? I just want the truth.
Like, I'm being honest.
So it's
about two times a week.
Okay.
About, I don't know, six times a month. That was two.
But when you're telling me two times a week, that's only crime.
Your driver's license number?
Yes.
513-0066.
Wait, do you have a medical marijuana card?
You applying for one?
Are you applying for one? Okay. How often do you use, when you use crank, are you injecting, snorting, smoking? When you say you're using away from the house, is that just on the camper?
Um,
On the PCS2, Your Honor, he's 1G. It's 18 months supervised to impose all that. 18 months, all the standard drug conditions, comply with count one, and another $100 unitary assessment. He's got an assault four. He's on probation four right now. He's got a theft one conviction and a criminal mischief that date back a ways, and I thought the 15 days would be appropriate.
Who'd you assault? Who did you assault?
They say that I assaulted her. I signed a conditional release to be released from jail. And I didn't comply with their conditional release. So it's held on already.
What about her?
On her, Your Honor, on the mistreatment, she's a 7H. She had one prior misdemeanor. Same 180 over 90 with
a misdemeanor.
She had a contempt of court, but that's not the one that I think makes her the age, because contempt is it. A furnishing alcohol in 1989, that's Class A, Your Honor. 7H, 3 years supervised. Her sanction, I think, 3 units of community service, and no jail because she doesn't have the history that he does. Comply with all terms and conditions of juvenile SCF, contact with the kids at the same direction. I think it would be appropriate, and I've treated people in the same position, that she get misdemeanor treatment on the mistreatment only if she completes everything that's required. Otherwise, it'd stick as a felony. On the drug charge, she's a 7H, or a 1H, I'm sorry. Same conditions, 90 over 30, 18 months supervised probation, the standard drug conditions, and comply with count one and the assessments.
How old are the children?
Children are 7 and 2.
How are they doing?
They're doing very well in the foster home. In the beginning, it was rough for them, but they're doing very well. They're having weekly visits with the parents.
Why was it rough?
Every time they would eat, they would have to ask if they had to wrap it up and put it somewhere so the cockroaches wouldn't get it. Also, the 7-year-old has mentioned that he likes at the foster home because he's not cold.
Your Honor, Officer Bennett had some words with the older boy, with the boy, and I think they sort of feed into what Ms. Anderson is speaking of at the scene.
Sure.
Your Honor, Jonathan, the oldest boy, stated to me during the arrest and prior to foster care, temporary foster care arriving. As you can tell from the video, there was only like one or two light bulbs working in the house. The living room was completely dark, and as I searched the house, I found several pieces of paper which looked like homework. Jonathan asked me if he could borrow my flashlight because, for one, he was scared of the dark, and two, that his only concern that night, that day, was that he wanted to go to school, and that's the only thing he had left, and he needed his homework to go to school the next day, and I helped him find a piece of homework, which was some math equations, and he was very thankful for that.
You want to say?
Say.
Ma'am, you talk to me.
I don't know what to say.
Try.
I don't believe that my son asked him for a flashlight, and the lighting in the house was not my fault.
Whose fault was it?
Well, there was no light fixtures in the living room to begin with.
How about lamps?
I didn't have any.
Why not?
Because I can't afford to buy them.
Where do you work?
I don't work.
Why not?
Because I'm thinking about going to a doctor to check to see what's wrong with my back, because my arm's been going numb.
And how long has that been happening?
Just a couple of weeks.
And prior to a couple of weeks, where did you work?
I didn't.
Why not?
I stayed home with the children.
And did what with the children? You clearly didn't take care of them.
I thought I was, to the best of my ability.
That's the best of your ability? Counsel, I'm talking to her. You're not going to help her.
I don't know.
You know how to do a washing machine?
No. My washing machine had just recently broke down.
What's recently?
About a couple weeks before this happened.
Why couldn't you do it by hand or go to a laundromat?
I didn't have funds to go to a laundromat, and I was doing clothes as we need them by hand.
Why were they laying all over the floor?
Because I was sorting them that day.
Why all the cockroaches?
Because the landlord wouldn't come in and have anything sprayed, like I asked.
Why didn't you spray it?
Because it's not my responsibility. Keep them out of the house.
Why didn't you spray them, sir?
We sprayed as we had funds to get laid and stuff. We sprayed on a daily basis when we were out. And then the ones that just show up in that one cupboard, we never opened that cupboard.
Why didn't you do the dishes?
There was no hot water, and we were doing them on a daily basis.
Why didn't you have hot water?
Because the gas was shut off, because I couldn't afford to pay the bill.
What do you make?
Right now, I make maybe approximately around $200 a month.
How many hours do you work a month?
A little less than 100 right now. No, I'm just working part-time at Weathersfield.
Why don't you have a full-time job?
I'm looking for a full-time job. I recently was hired at Rock and Rogers. I worked there for about 2 weeks, and then they let me go. And they said that I was walking into the other club to get stuff. I still don't understand why they let me go. They never really gave me a reason.
Why can't you afford to do laundry and dishes?
$5 a load to do laundry on a laundry day.
How much is methamphetamine?
I don't know. I wasn't paying for it.
Who was giving it to you?
Diane Rosman. Once in a while, she would come over and give some to us, and then sometimes we'd say we didn't want it.
You never paid for it?
Not very often, no.
But you did sometimes.
Yeah.
How many complaints did you have on these people?
We had complaints coming back from March of 98.
Your Honor, we received a drug house complaint of basically piece of paper that's generated from information that complaint is given to us. Received such a complaint about this residence, and the complaint came handwritten from an anonymous person, which basically, to sum it up, stated that this person that initiated the complaint was a user. They had allegedly purchased methamphetamine from these two folks. And while inside of the house during that purchase, they were so disgusted by the living conditions and the way these two children were treated that they couldn't live with themselves. They said that this person was sorry for their drug use, but couldn't have a clean conscience if this person didn't tell and inform the authorities of the way these children were being treated.
Didn't you both go to jail?
My kids on the outside.
Give me a break. Why shouldn't you go to jail?
Because I want to try to clear this up so that I can get on my life and be with
what
my
have you
kids.
Done to clear it up?
I haven't been told to do anything yet.
Why does anybody have to tell you what to do? If you're old enough to be a mother, you ought to be able to figure out how to raise kids.
I know how to raise kids.
No, ma'am, you don't. All right. I frankly didn't hear much contrition. I hear it was everybody else's fault, the landlord's fault, the whatever. The machinery breaking down.
It's partly our fault for not keeping the place.
Sir. Watching the tape, you got me a little bit angry. You ought not make it worse. Listen, the wife, she's got nothing but a bunch of stinking excuses. Agree with the DA. I think they both ought to do jail time. That house is disgusting. They didn't care about the kids. I mean, they could both go to work. We've got, what, 4% unemployment? Explain to me why they can't get a job. I'll adopt the DA's recommendations, except that she'll do 15 days, he'll do 30, and they'll start it on Monday so they get their visitation and their work. Make sure they show up, Mr. Biglow, for the jail and let them get in, and let me know.
I will, Your Honor.
Now, Mr. Biglow.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm directing you to call Mr. Nelson out of the jail. Tell him about the tape if he wants to see it, and that these people ought not be doing an early release.
I will do so, Your Honor.
If you two don't have a job by the end of February and have your act together, I'm going to be your worst nightmare.
We had some testimony from the agency about chemical labs, and we've had testimony this film just still gets me because it's no child should be in that kind of environment. And I have seen this film, and there's another one out that's just as bad as this one. And, you know, we're asked why we're talking about work that our agency do with respect to drugs and alcohol, with respect to trying to clean up environments, with trying to protect children. And I just wanted you to have, to see the real world that's out there. You know, we sit here and we hear individuals coming before us who talk about their problems and their concerns. And sometimes I think it's somewhat detached because we don't really see what's going on out there in our communities. And this film that happened in Salem, I suspect that if we called every one of your communities in this state, that they would have the same kind of stories to tell. I said when I came back into this building as a legislator that Oregon cannot be proud that we have one of the highest abuse and neglect rates in this country. We cannot be proud that we have the level of methamphetamine and drug use in this state. And we cannot be proud if we're not taking care of our children. And I just needed to share that with you today. And with that, I think it's enough, and I'm going to adjourn until tomorrow.